This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, everything that Tom and I have been up to on Thursday, July the 15th. That includes quite the oil chat this morning. After a clarifying statement from the Ministry of Economy, we've been speaking to the oil broker Matt Stanley. We've also been having a look at some comments coming out from the IEA, the International Energy Agency, about whether or not rising oil prices could fuel, pun intended, the adoption of electric vehicles. We've been speaking to Kevin Chaloup from EV Lab. To staycation or not to staycation? That is the question that we have been putting to Gregor Amon from the guys at Hotel Data Cloud, having a look statistically at what we are all doing this Eid. And the DFSA has imposed a record fine for an individual on the former CFO of Abraj Capital. We'll hear from the acting CEO, Peter Smith. All of that, plus Serena, has been singing your COVID news this morning.
Ask Serena.
Good morning, Miss Kelly.
Good morning, guys. You're in a good mood, Tom.
You told me to be in a good mood.
I did.
Oh, no. Sorry, it was Isa told me to be in a good mood today. She said I was being a bit miserable yesterday, so I need to be in a good mood.
No, he wasn't.
Actually, no, I'll tell you why. No, that would be throwing under the bus.
What, who, me or Isa?
No, Isa just gave me so Isa's producing the show at the moment, and I like Isa because she says it as it is.
Mm. Huh? Yep.
She gives it to you straight.
Yep.
All right?
No messing around with her.
So she said, any chance that you could be good today because we haven't got enough content for the weekend?
You didn't! Raise your game, Tom.
Fair play. Can't really argue with that one. Cheers, Eyes.
No one told me to raise my game. Do you think that's because they think we're beyond hope?
No. It's just that you're Brandy and you're just constantly practically perfect in every way.
She's always in there in the offices.
I feel overlooked. Yeah.
I was leaving the other day and she was still here. I was
first
like, why
one
are you
in,
still
last
here?
One out. Yeah. Teacher's pet. Yeah.
Serena Kelly.
Yes. Where would you like to begin?
Oh, let's start with the numbers.
Okay. So over the last few days, you've had figures 1,542, 1,522, and yesterday, new cases, 1,529. So that's after more than 286,600 tests were conducted. You also had 1,481 recoveries. 4 fatalities. So total deaths in the country now stands at 1,880. And active cases, we've gone up from 20,114 to 20,158. And then if we look at active cases internationally, Lebanon, more than 6,300 active cases there, more than 10,900 in Saudi Arabia. Egypt's looking at more than 46,400 active cases. And Oman has seen a drop, currently more than 22,400 active cases there.
Right. We've got some green list updates from Abu Dhabi.
That's right. So 13 new places have been added. We have Albania, Armenia, Belgium, Canada, France, Hungary, Jordan, the Netherlands, Ireland, Romania, Seychelles, which already was a safe travel corridor anyway, Turkmenistan and Vatican City. So some have been removed. Bhutan, Brunei, Finland, Greenland, Japan, Morocco, Portugal, Spain, Uzbekistan. So green list means no quarantine on arrival in Abu Dhabi, just the relevant PCR tests. Not on the green list, you do need to quarantine. So that was recently increased. Vaccinated, quarantine 7 days, and then unvaccinated, it is 12 days. Meanwhile, the standard rules still apply with those countries that have established a safe travel corridor with the UAE. So no quarantine so long as you are fully vaccinated. And to be classed as fully vaccinated, it needs to have been 28 days that have passed since your second jab.
So I've got a question on this one.
Go for it.
Abu Dhabi's green list. Is that different to Dubai's green list?
Dubai doesn't have a green list.
Why don't we have a list?
What do you mean, why don't we have a list?
Why can't we have a list? Everyone else has got a list.
Well, no, they don't, actually.
Yeah, they do.
It's only Abu Dhabi.
UK's got a list. Abu Dhabi's got a list.
Okay, but it's Dubai's got the approach that everybody takes a PCR test aboard, and then depending on the country you're coming from, you may need to take a second test upon arrival and then isolate until those results come in. But apart from that, there is no quarantine. The only quarantine that is in place is currently in Abu Dhabi.
Okay.
All other Emirates are fine. Sharjah is fine. It's standard PCR testing protocols, which you should check before traveling. And yeah, so like I said, it's either, but all airlines, it is compulsory PCR test to board. And depending on the country you're coming from, in most cases, the results can't be more than 72 hours old. Some cases it's 48. But like I said, there is a chance that you might get tested again on arrival in Dubai. For example, if my mum was coming from New Zealand right now, test to board the flight, but she wouldn't need to test on arrival in Dubai.
Tell you what I found, what else I found interesting yesterday, and that clarifies a lot, because I think, yeah, we expect there to be a list here, but there isn't. But it is done by a country by country basis,
yes,
isn't it?
You can, very much so.
If you can get a flight to Dubai from a country, as long as you PCR and as long as you get a negative result, then you're all good, etc. But, you know, getting a flight from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh,
currently suspended,
UK, blah, 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 you know, is tough at the moment for a lot of people. But then looking at flights out of here and options, and this one I found interesting. Yesterday, Emirates resuming its Dubai to Malta via Larnaca service for the first time since March of this year.
Mm-hmm.
And being very clear about it. You know how before it was like, oh, yeah, but do you need vaccine? Do you not need vaccine? Very clear about it. Travellers must have two doses of a European Medicines Authority approved vaccine. And everyone goes, okay, what's that? Moderna, Pfizer, AstraZeneca, Oxford or Johnson & Johnson. That's it. What about Sinopharm? Nah, not eligible at this stage.
At this stage.
Clear.
Yeah.
Very clear.
Yeah.
I like that. Clarity.
Speaking of clarity, a couple of questions for you.
Yes.
Serena, what if, well, not just Serena, all my morning drive buddies. There you go.
Aww.
What if I arrive from a greenless country in Dubai? Can I then travel to Abu Dhabi?
You can, but you were, so green list means you would still, you don't need to quarantine. But if you arrived into Dubai and it was a country not on Abu Dhabi's green list, then all quarantine protocols would still apply if you were heading straight to Abu Dhabi. Some people would actually arrive in Dubai, and if it's a non-green list country, they would sort of wait it out in Dubai first and then make their way through to Abu Dhabi. So it's literally, if you were vaccinated and it's 7 days quarantine, some people would do the week in Dubai before then travelling through to Abu Dhabi. That's one option, but otherwise travel through to Abu Dhabi and you would need to isolate.
Okay, Serena, is there somewhere we can see a list of where you can get a saliva COVID test for kids?
Interesting, because the Barsha clinic was in Jumeirah. Abasha, near all of the Emirates. Yes, thank you. Sorry, it's been a really long evening, night, morning. Yes, synapse is trying to fire. Yes, so Barsha, the clinic, the health clinic there, they were initiating the saliva testing, but then they removed PCR testing. So I would ring ahead and check if they're still offering the saliva testing. Otherwise, maybe depending on the Emirate you're in, for example, get onto the DHA website. They might be able to provide a list there. But that is something that we can look into for you.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Looking at one of our top business stories this morning, the news that former Abraj CFO Ashish Dave has been fined $1.7 million US dollars by the Dubai Financial Services Authority for his involvement in activities leading to the collapse of Abraj collapsed in 2019 with more than $1 billion of debt. We are joined by Peter Smith. He is the acting chief executive of the DFSA. Peter, good morning. It's lovely to speak to you.
Morning, Brandy.
Could you talk us through exactly what Ashish Dave has been fined for?
Yes, certainly. His wrongdoing at the Abraj Group was significant, and that's very much reflected in the size of the fine. As the CFO, he obviously had visibility over the financial affairs of the group. He had the opportunity to expose and bring misconduct and breaches to a halt. But instead, he became involved in the web of deception of Abraj stakeholders that has taken place. So the fine, as you said, is the largest one we've imposed on an individual. It reflects a number of things. Mr. Dave didn't take action when the compliance function within the firm raised issues about unauthorized activity. And obviously the compliance function is a thing that we as regulators rely on within a firm. He was involved in deceiving investors and the auditors about the misuse of funds from some of the Abrage funds. And he misled ourselves as the regulator about the capital position of companies within the group. So there's a range of issues which all add up to a very serious incidence of misconduct, and that, in our view, obviously fully warrants the fine that we've imposed on Mr. Dave.
Tell me about the investigation that the DFSA has undergone to get to this point.
So the investigation obviously started when we first heard of concerns at the Abrage Group in very early 2018. And as you know, we took action against some of the companies in the Abrage Group during 2019. Since then, we've been investigating the activities of a range of individuals who've been involved in this. And that involves obviously looking not only at what happened, but at who was responsible for what had happened, and trying to unpick who was actually responsible amongst the individuals in the management of the Abrage Group. So the process we follow is obviously one that takes place in private. It involves exchange of written views between the people affected, between ourselves and between the individuals concerned. And then we appoint a decision maker who has now made this decision that's resulted in the fine. And the decision maker sometimes will hold hearings with the individuals concerned and so on. So we have to follow proper procedures, give individuals their proper rights as we go through a process like this. And obviously we need to get the details right if we're going to reach conclusions of the sort that we've reached in the case of Mr. Dave.
How do you arrive at the amount to be fined? How do you decide that 1.7 million is where it should sit?
Yeah, that's a good question. We have a set process that's set out in one of our many publications, and it's a five-step process that we go through. We look, first of all, whether the individual benefited personally from the misconduct. So are there specific monies or payments that we can attribute? And we would look to disgorge those payments, i.e. recover those payments, if that was the case. We then look at the seriousness of the matter. And in the case of Mr. Dave, obviously very serious misconduct indeed. We then look at what we call mitigating and aggravating factors. Does it make it worse or better? We then step back and look at, does the size of the fine give a proper message about deterrence to the market? Is it likely to prevent other individuals in a similar position from carrying out similar or other misconduct? So deterrence is obviously a key element here. And then the last element, we look at whether the individual is willing to settle with us or not. If they do settle, we give them a discount. So and we go through those steps. When we're at the first stage, we say, well, what are we going to base it on? And in the case of individuals like Mr. Dave, we will base it on the remuneration that he received during his employment, in his case, in two different stages with the Abrage Group.
Well, this is a record fine to date for the DFSA for an individual. Marie has messaged in and asked the question that I think everyone is asking. How will you be able to get the money?
Well, we have a track record of enforcing fines over the years, the 15, 16 years that the DFSA has been in operation. And we will pursue Mr. Dave to seek repayment, to seek payment of the fine. We do have a number of successes in enforcing payment of fines in other jurisdictions. So we will do what we normally do. We will provide the appropriate papers to Mr. Dave in due course, And we will then pursue the fine wherever he's currently residing.
Is this the last case to do with the branch? Have you still got more ongoing?
No, I think it's fair to say we still have more ongoing, as you would probably expect. I can't comment in detail on the other cases. A number of them are very close to the end of the process that we go through, but we're not yet in a position where we can comment on the findings.
How important is it to go through this process from a reputational point of view for the DFSA? Abrage once a bit of a poster child back in the day for the financial centre. How much of this is showing how tough you guys are when things go wrong?
Well, I think with issues of misconduct within firms, you can't necessarily prevent that looking from the outside like a regulator, particularly in situations like this when some of the checks and balances don't work as they should have. I mentioned the compliance function earlier. So what is important is how the regulator clears up the mess afterwards, if I can put it that way. And I think in this case and in others, it's actually crucial that we illustrate to clients, to customers, to potential investors, to people wanting to set up firms in the DIFC, that people are held to high standards. And if they don't meet those high standards, there will be appropriate action taken and appropriate penalties imposed on them. So I think it's absolutely essential that people understand that the DIFC is a well-regulated jurisdiction and a jurisdiction where action will be taken if people step out of line, and particularly if they step out of line in a big way, as has happened in the Abrage case.
1 minute left with you, so let's keep this tight. But have you changed anything in terms of oversight, regulation, compliance in the DIFC in light of the Abrage collapse?
We haven't changed our rules so much. We have refocused some of our supervision effort, I think it's fair to say, looking more at companies who have Abrage-like structures, if I can say that, where they have companies in multiple jurisdictions with providing services between the different entities in the group. So we have focused on that, and we've taken a number of more low-key and private actions to address some issues that we've seen there. So that's been the main change. But I think overall, it is all about building up the and reinforcing the fact that good governance matters in firms, it matters in private equity, and it matters everywhere else. It's critical for investor trust and confidence.
And Peter Smith is the Acting Chief Executive of the Dubai Financial Services Authority, speaking to us about that $1.7 million fine, a record fine for an individual held down by the Dubai Financial Services Authority for the former CFO of Abrage for his part in the private equity firm's demise.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
So just look at the evidence put in front of you. Schools out for summer, work from home is acceptable, summer holidays are upon us. Ooh, and there's a long Eid as well. All the ingredients you need for a good break. Time now to talk vacations, staycations, and sanitising stations as well, with none other than the managing partner and the co-founder of Hotel Data Cloud. They help hotels win back control of the descriptive content on their booking channels, increase bookings with personalised content and smart recommendations. Their managing partner and co-founder is Gregor Amont, who joins us live on the line and live via Microsoft Teams. Gregor, good morning to you.
Thanks for having me.
No, not at all. Great to have you on board as always. Let's turn to the data if we can, because obviously It's something that you have your finger very much on the pulse of. In terms of travel related searches, are we seeing an uptick in terms of those searches at the moment, or are people quite happy to stay?
No, we definitely see an uptake on searches. And I think everybody who has a large social media following can see that a lot of people are traveling right now. We see a lot of people going to Greece. We see a lot of people going to Europe because thanks to the current vaccination drive of the UAE, all the residents who are vaccinated can travel to Europe without quarantine period. But what we've also seen at HTC, and the lines are a little bit blurry to decide, is it something to do with Eid or is it something because of the summer break? Because that sort of coincides now next week. We also see a lot of people who have staycations in the UAE. So staycations, from our point of view, are definitely here to stay because people in the last year have seen the tremendous possibilities they have in the UAE. In all the seven Emirates, there's amazing offerings, also now during Eid. And we see that very strongly in the booking data.
Let's stay with the domestic staycation market, if we can, for a moment. I think it goes without saying that it is stronger than usual because of the limits on people, for destinations that people can get to, plus that uncertainty as well. Are those elements, especially the uncertainty, fueling the demand for staycation?
Yes, not only the uncertainty, I think. I mean, if you look at the quite large amount of countries where people are not allowed to travel back to the UAE, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, that's a large chunk of people that normally would be traveling during the season now, back home to visit their families. That is something that is not happening. But those people still want to get some time off, especially now during Eid. So we see an increase in staycations booking from those. But also, there are people, despite vaccinations, who are at the moment not feeling safe to travel yet. Those are the people who will also stay in the UAE.
Can you still get a good deal when it comes to staycations, or are hoteliers and hotel brands taking advantage of the demand?
No, we absolutely have not seen that. There's still very good deals to get. About 50% of the hoteliers that we've spoke to said they have about 60 to 70% occupation within the next couple of weeks. So that's definitely good stuff to get out there.
Are staycations going to remain as a thing? Are staycations here to stay? Or as and when we get to a stage where more and more destinations, more and more areas are opening up to international travel, will we forget staycations? Will it be a memory of the pandemic?
No, we don't believe that. Staycations are definitely here to stay. People have seen how awesome it is to just get in the car, drive for about an hour and be at something that feels completely different than what it is at home. I think the duration of staycation will change. Once travel opens up completely, the longer vacations people do, a week or 2 weeks, they're going to do abroad. But like the short-term things, longer weekends, even a break during the week sometimes, staycations is the way to go.
One of the accusations levelled at hotels and hoteliers in the past, pre-pandemic, was that they just sort of took residents and citizens for granted. It was a big, big focus on international tourists. Has the pandemic made hoteliers appreciate residents more?
Absolutely, yes. And we see that there's a lot of deals now exclusively for UAE residents that we're seeing. So there was a mind shift with the hotels to focus more on local travellers as well.
You mentioned vaccination a little earlier on, Gregor, and I was wondering whether vaccination and the vaccination drive that we're having here in the UAE, which is, you know, one of the best, if not the best in the world, is that equaling confidence at the moment, the two hand in hand?
They are, and we've seen that 2021 was for the travel industry a little bit of an up and down. We have seen periods of very big optimism. We have seen periods of, let's say, cautious optimism, to put it like that. But vaccination definitely helps. We see that in Europe. In Europe, we have now everybody sort of bracing for the fourth wave. That is mainly because people are not as vaccinated as in the UAE. So we can be really lucky to be here.
What's the biggest challenge for those wanting to travel over the course of the next couple of weeks, the next couple of months? Is it those restrictions in other parts of the world? Is it the risk of a fourth wave?
It is the risk, and it is also the risk of a change in regulations. We've seen that, and that's one of the things we implemented relatively quickly in the pandemic, to be able to give hotels the opportunity to communicate those changes really easy to their travelers. Because if a government decides to shut down, if a government decides to impose further restrictions, that can happen within a few days. So that is the biggest challenge that travelers are facing nowadays.
What about you and your team, Gregor? How's COVID-19 impacted your business here? Because obviously you set up pilot originally by trade over in your homeland, and then of course set up Hotel Data Cloud here several years ago. Have you been impacted?
Absolutely. At the beginning, I'm not going to lie, I called Kevin, my co-founder, who was on your show earlier, and I said, Kevin, we're in the worst industry possible. Let's see if we survive. But as counterintuitive as it sounds, pandemic actually helped HTC grow bigger and faster than we anticipated. The hotel industry is not necessarily an industry that is known for innovation. Sometimes it needs a little bit of a push to rethink things they have done in the past, they have done over the last 50 years. More and more hotels are now understanding that they need to be innovative, that they need to digitize in order to come out at the other side more victorious and recoup some of the losses they had last year. So that has helped HTC tremendously to get that mind shift into the whole industry, to become an industry leader.
And you've been recognized by the United Nations as well. Congratulations for being recognized as a healing solutions for tourism. All that hard work obviously paying off.
I hope so. And there are bright days ahead for HTC.
In terms of our sort of relationship with data, something that you're very close to, again, obviously you focus very much on all things hospitality and hotels, but has our relationship with data changed, do you think, during the pandemic? Have we become more dependent on the data?
We have to, and I think that's a good thing, because we have the technology that's out there. I think I'm a big believer in embracing technological possibilities that we have, and the more data we have, the more data we can analyze, of course, with necessary privacy rules in place. we can use it for the greater good of everybody.
Last question from the Business Breakfast team to the Hotel Data Cloud team. Are the two founders, you and your co-founder, Kevin, are the founders of Hotel Data Cloud vacationing or staycationing this summer?
Well, we have a mix. Kevin is currently vacationing in South Africa to see part of his family. I stay in Dubai. I keep tab over all our employees and make sure that HTC keeps running.
Good on you. Great to get chat with you as always, Gregor. Really appreciate
Likewise.
Your time.
Thank you very much.
Gregor is the managing partner and the co-founder of Hotel Data Cloud, HDC, joining us live on the line and live via Microsoft Teams. Again, more optimism. We're looking for chinks in the armor out there at the moment, Brandy, when it comes to getting away or not. They just don't seem to be there. A lot of positivity.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Well, we do have a bit of an energy focus on the Business Breakfast this morning. Not just looking at what is happening or not happening with OPEC Plus after that statement from the Ministry of Energy and Infrastructure here in the UAE last night, but also some comments in the last 48 hours from the International Energy Agency, or IEA. They say that rising oil prices could speed the shift to electric vehicles. Now, we are down a couple of dollars this morning. We are at $74.06 for Brent, but we are still over 70 and we are still up substantially on where we were at the beginning of the year. We are joined now by Kevin Shaloup, founder and CEO of the Electric Vehicle Specialists EV Lab. Kevin, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Brandy.
What do you make of the IEA's comments?
It's interesting to see the fluctuation of oil prices in the last couple of months with COVID. It's true that with higher prices, we do see a favorable market for electric vehicles. We've seen this in the rest of the GCC, in Egypt and Jordan, in two countries where fossil fuel prices have remained high and electric vehicles have accelerated. The rest of the world will be closer to shifting towards electric with higher prices.
Well, look, we've seen a number of price rises at the pump this year. We're up about 30% for petrol, but it is still subsidised and it is still under what you would pay in a completely free market, what you'd pay in other countries to fill up your car. Does that stop us from moving to electric vehicles? Does that mitigate that pain point for us?
I would argue fuel prices aren't the only reason to buy an electric car. I do think these are more performing cars as well, more technologically advanced, better for the planet, more sustainable. And today we do see that the infrastructure is ready to support electrification, especially here in Dubai. So I would say, in my purchase decision at least, it's not the only factor that comes in.
Where are we in adoption locally then?
You know, during COVID, the market grew about 72%. It's one of the few industries that did grow.
Is that in the UAE or?
Correct, here in the UAE. We now have almost 2,500 electric vehicles on the road as of February. So we're seeing a good growth in this market, and there is an appeal for electric cars. I think COVID has shown that collective action can solve big problems. We've solved the pandemic by wearing masks, getting vaccinated. The next big issue for us to solve collectively is really climate change, and now we're asking to make more conscious decisions when buying an electric car is one of them.
But I'm looking at the number of cars that were sold in 2019, around 235,000 vehicles, according to the internet. So if we are 2,500 on the road, that is just about 1% of what was actually sold last year. And that is nowhere near the amount of vehicles on our roads.
Correct. I mean, we're still at 1% here in the UAE. Some markets have grown faster, some markets slower. I mean, the good win is that we've doubled the amount almost of vehicles in the year of COVID, of electric vehicles on the road. And we're hoping to see this exponential growth that we've seen with COVID for electric.
Why do you think we've seen that growth during COVID? What's your theory?
Two potential reasons. One is more conscious buying. I think once again, people are more aware of the emissions that road transportation have. 40.7 million cubic tons of carbon are emitted here in the UAE just due to road transportation. That's about 18% of the total emissions. And also because they're more exciting products. I mean, Tesla has been the market leader, but no, they're no longer the only option available. But if you have a better performing car, also better for the planet, I think we're going to see that shift very fast and more consumers.
Has there been anything about the pandemic itself, though, that's spurred growth in electric cars? I mean, we're not traveling as much. Maybe we've got a bit of extra cash.
Definitely. I mean, buyers have stayed home, had time to think about their new purchases at home, their new purchases for their cars, and saved cash. So it's true that it is at the once we reopened that the market really shifted and grew from September onwards. So with that amount of time and cash available, people did think it could be a good time to buy a new car.
Well, you guys, before I let you go, are working on the UAE's first multi-brand electric vehicle store. So a physical shop that would have numerous electric vehicles in it rather than just from one car supplier. Where are you on that at the moment?
Correct. I mean, we're testing our hypothesis today with a couple of cool initiatives. We launched our website and just launched our pop-up, which is at Mall of the Emirates until July 17th. We'll also be in Murdif City Center from August 15th to 24. It's very exciting to see the sheer amount of people that get interested in such products that weren't aware of some of the products that were available and that get curious. What's most fascinating is the amount of kids that come by our booth. I keep on saying, you know, I'm part of the generation that grew up with the hope of a more sustainable future. We're doing this as well for them. We think, you know, this is also part of the reason we should consider electric cars when buying a new car next.
Kevin Chaloub is the founder and CEO of the electric vehicle specialists EV Lab, speaking to us this morning on the back of those comments from the IEA.
Let's counter that with news that won't be readily accepted by all those looking to embrace all things electric, and that is news from ADNOC overnight as well. Pretty significant news as well. Mm-hmm. Abu Dhabi National Oil Company awarding $763.7 million worth of contracts. That's 2.8 billion dirhams to expand production from its offshore Upper Zakum and Satar al-Razbout, or the Saab fields. It aims to raise production capacity to 5 million barrels per day by 2030. You don't need to be an Einstein to work out there is a bit of a disparity there between the visions of electric vehicles by 2025, 5 million barrels a day by 2030 as well. You do the math, there will be demand for all, I'm sure.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.